millimeters to meters of surface and volume, not nanometers or kilometers. Our unaided minds dwell entirely in organismic space. Imagine now that with the best of our instruments and his permission, we can look into the brain of Pablo Amaringo. By magnifying the image, his smallest nerves come into view. Then we see the constituent cells, and finally, the molecules and atoms. We watch as a nerve cell discharges. Along the length of its membrane, the voltage drops as sodium ions flow inward. At each point on the shaft of the nerve cell, the events consume only several thousandths of a second. While the electrical signal they create, the drop in voltage, speeds along the shaft at 10 meters a second, as fast as an Olympic sprinter. With our field of vision now brought to a space only 1/10,000th that of our original field, the events occur too swiftly to be seen. An electric discharge of the cell membrane crosses the field of vision faster than a rifle bullet. To see it, remember, as human observers we are still in organismic time, we must record and slow the action down enough to witness events that originally occurred in a few thousandths of a second or less. We are now in biochemical time, a necessity if we are to observe events in biochemical space. In the midst of this magic, Amaringo keeps talking, but is scarcely aware of the changes that occurred as our own actions accelerated a thousandfold. Only enough of his time has elapsed for one or two words to be spoken. We turn the dials in the opposite direction, shift time and space, until his full image reappears and his words flow through our minds at an audible pace. We turn the dials further. Amaringo shrinks in proportionate size and speed walks jerkily out of the room, like an actor in an early silent film. Perhaps he does so in frustration, because we are now frozen in position like marble statues. Our vision continues to expand. Let us rise in the air to gather more space. Our view grows to encompass the town of Pucallpa, and then a large stretch of the Rio Ucayali Valley. Houses disappear. New ones pop up. Day blends with night into continuous twilight as the flicker fusion frequency of our organismic time vision is exceeded. Amaringo grows old. He dies. His children grow old. They die. Nearby, the rainforest is changing. Clearings appear as great trees fall. Saplings spring up. The gaps close. We are now in ecological time. We turn the dials again, and space-time expands still more. Individual persons and other organisms are no longer distinguishable, only blurred populations of anacondas, ayahuasca vines, the people of central Peru. And these can be seen across the passage of generations. A century of their time collapses into a minute of ours. Some of their genes are changing, in both kind and relative frequency. Detached from other human beings and shorn of their emotions, godlike at last, we witness the world in evolutionary time and space. This conception of scale is the means by which the biological sciences have become consilient during the past 50 years. According to the magnitude of time and space adopted for analysis, the basic divisions of biology are from top to bottom as follows: evolutionary biology, ecology, organismic biology, cellular biology, molecular biology, and biochemistry. That sequence is also the basis of the organization of professional societies and of the curricula of colleges and universities. The degree of consilience can be measured by the degree to which the principles of each division can be telescoped into those of the others. The interlocking of the biological disciplines, a tidy concept, is still compromised in execution by the dilemma of the labyrinth with which I began this chapter. Consilience among the disciplines grows more smoothly from the top down as more links are laid in place from the most specific of the entities, such as the brain of Amerigo, all the way to the most general, his atoms and molecules. But to establish consilience the other way, from general to more specific, is vastly more difficult. In short, it is far easier to analyze Amerigo than to synthesize him. The greatest obstacle to consilience by synthesis, the approach often loosely called holism, is the exponential increase in complexity encountered during the upward progress through levels of organization. I have already described how an entire cell cannot yet be predicted from a knowledge of its scrambled molecules and organelles alone. Let me now indicate how bad the problem really is. It is not even possible to predict the three-dimensional structure of a protein from a complete knowledge of its constituent atoms. The composition of amino acids can be determined, and the exact position of each atom can be mapped precisely with the aid of X-ray crystallography. We know, to choose one of the simplest proteins, that the insulin molecule is a sphere containing 51 amino acids. Such reconstruction is one of the many triumphs of reductionist biology. But this knowledge of the sequence of all the amino acids and of the atoms composing them is not enough to predict the shape of the sphere or its internal structure as revealed by X-ray crystallography. In principle, the prediction of the forms of proteins is possible. Synthesis at the level of macromolecules is a technical, not a conceptual problem. The effort to solve it is, in fact, an important industry in biochemistry. To have such knowledge would be a major breakthrough in medicine. Synthetic proteins, some perhaps more effective than the natural molecules, could be created upon demand to combat disease-causing organisms and remedy enzyme deficiencies. In practice, however, the difficulties seem almost insurmountable. Making the prediction requires a summation of all the energy relationships among nearby atoms. That alone is daunting, but then the interactions of more distantly separated atoms in the molecule must be added. The forces shaping the molecule comprise an immensely complex web of thousands of energy contributions, all of which must be integrated simultaneously in order to form the whole. Some biochemists believe that to achieve that final step, each energy contribution in turn must be calculated with an accuracy still beyond the grasp of the physical sciences. Even greater difficulties exist in the environmental sciences. The paramount challenge to ecology for the foreseeable future is the cracking apart and resynthesis of the assemblages of organisms that occupy ecosystems, particularly the most complex ecosystems such as estuaries and rainforests. Most studies in ecology focus on only one or two species of organisms at a time out of the thousands occupying a typical habitat. The researchers, forced into reductionism by practical necessity, start with small fragments of the whole ecosystem. Yet they are aware that the fate of each species is determined by the diverse actions of scores or hundreds of other species that variously photosynthesize, browse, graze, decompose, hunt, fall prey, and turn soil around the target species. The ecologists know this principle very well, but they still can do little about predicting its precise manifestation in any particular case. Even more than biochemists manipulating atoms in a large molecule, the ecologists face immeasurable dynamic relationships among still largely unknown combinations of species. Consider this example of the complexity they face. When Gatun Lake was created during the construction of the Panama Canal in 1912, the rising waters cut off a piece of elevated land. The new isolate, covered by tropical evergreen forest, was named Barro Colorado Island and made into a biological research station. In the following decades, it became the most closely studied ecosystem of its kind in the world. The size of the island, 17 square kilometers, was too small to sustain jaguars and pumas. The prey of the great cats had consisted partly of agoutis and pacas, outsized rodents that vaguely resemble jackrabbits and small deer. These animals, freed from a major cause of mortality, multiplied to 10 times their original numbers. They overexploited their own food, which consists mostly of large seeds that fall from the forest canopy, which caused a reduction in the reproduction and abundance of the tree species that produce the seeds. The effect rippled outward. Other tree species whose seeds are too small to be of interest to the agoutis and pacas benefited from the reduced competition. Their seeds set more abundantly, and their seedlings flourished, and a larger number of the young trees reached full height and reproductive age. It was inevitable, then, that the animal species specialized to feed on small seed trees also prospered, that the predators depending on these animals increased, that the fungi and bacteria parasitizing the small seed trees and associated animals spread, that the microscopic animals feeding on the fungi and bacteria grew denser, that the predators of these creatures increased in turn, and so on across the food web and back again, as the ecosystem reverberated from the restriction of its area and consequent loss of its top carnivores. The greatest challenge today, not just in cell biology and ecology, but in all of science, is the accurate and complete description of complex systems. Scientists have broken down many kinds of systems. They think they know most of the elements and forces. The next task is to reassemble them, at least in mathematical models that capture the key properties of the entire ensembles. Success in this enterprise will be measured by the power researchers acquire to predict emergent phenomena when passing from general to more specific levels of organization. That, in simplest terms, is the great challenge of scientific holism. Physicists, whose subject matter is the simplest in science, have already succeeded, in part, by treating individual particles, such as nitrogen atoms, as random agents. They have deduced the patterns that emerge when the particles act together in large assemblages. Statistical mechanics, originated in the 19th century by James Clerk Maxwell, who also pioneered the theory of electromagnetic radiation, and Ludwig Boltzmann, accurately predicted the behavior of gases at different temperatures by the application of classical mechanics to the large numbers of freely moving molecules that compose the gases. Other researchers, by moving back and forth between the same two levels of organization, in other words, between molecules and gases, were further able to define viscosity, heat conduction, phase transition, and other macroscopic properties as expressions of the forces between the molecules. At the next level down, quantum theorists in the early 1900s connected the collective behavior of electrons and other subatomic particles to the classical physics of atoms and molecules. Through many such advances during the past century, physics has been welded into the most exact of the sciences. At higher, more specific levels of organization, beyond the traditional realm of physics, the difficulties of synthesis are almost inconceivably more difficult. Entities such as organisms and species, unlike electrons and atoms, are indefinitely variable. Worse, each particular one changes during development and evolution. Consider this example. Among the vast array of molecules that an organism can manufacture to serve its needs are simple hydrocarbons of the methane series, composed entirely of carbon and hydrogen atoms. With one carbon atom, only a single kind of molecule is possible. With 10 carbon atoms, the number is 75. With 20, it is 366,319. And with 40, it is 62 trillion. Add oxygen atoms here and there on the hydrocarbon chains to produce alcohols, aldehydes, and ketones. And the number rises even more rapidly with molecular size. Now select various subsets and imagine multiple ways they can be derived by enzyme-mediated manufacture. And you have potential complexity beyond the powers of present-day imagination. Biologists, it has been said, suffer from physics envy. They build physics-like models that lead from the microscopic to the macroscopic, but find it difficult to match them with the messy systems they experience in the real world. Theoretical biologists are nevertheless easily seduced. I confess to being one, and having been responsible for more than my share of failures. Armed with sophisticated mathematical concepts and high-speed computers, they can generate unlimited numbers of predictions about proteins, rainforests, and other complex systems. With the passage to each higher level of organization, they need to contrive new algorithms, which are sets of exactly defined mathematical operations pointed to the solution of given problems. And so, with artfully chosen procedures, they can create virtual worlds that evolve into more highly organized systems. Wandering through the Cretan labyrinth of cyberspace, they inevitably encounter emergence, the appearance of complex phenomena not predictable from the basic elements and processes alone, and not initially conceivable from the algorithms. And behold, some of the productions actually look like emergent phenomena found in the real world. Their hopes soar. They report the results at conferences of like-minded theoreticians. After a bit of questioning and probing, heads nod in approval. Yes, original, exciting, and important. If true. If true. If true. Folie de grandeur is their foible, the big picture their illusion. They are on the edge of a breakthrough. But how do they know that nature's algorithms are the same as their own, or even close? Many procedures may be false, and yet produce an approximately correct answer. The biologists are at special risk of committing the fallacy of affirming the consequent. It is wrong to assume that because a correct result was obtained by means of theory, the steps used to obtain it are necessarily the same as those that exist in the real world. To see this point clearly, think of a blossom in a painting rendered photographic in detail and as beautiful as life. In our minds, the macroscopic entity has truth because it matches real flowers sprung from the soil. From a distance, we might easily confuse the image with the real thing, but the algorithms that created it are radically different. Its microscopic elements are flakes of paint instead of chromosomes and cells. Its developmental pathways exist in the brain of the artist, not in prescription by DNA of the unfolding of tissues. How do theoreticians know that their computer simulations are not just the paintings of flowers? These and other difficulties, endemic to higher systems, have not gone unnoticed. Researchers from several scientific disciplines have joined to take the measure of the problems, forming a loose enterprise variously designated as complexity, complexity studies, or complexity theory. Complexity theory, the best expression in my opinion, can be defined as the search for algorithms used in nature that display common features across many levels of organization. At the very least, according to the proponents of complexity theory, the commonalities can be expected to provide an explorer's guide for quicker movement when passing from simple to more complex systems through the real-world labyrinth. The commonalities will assist in pruning all the algorithms that can be conceived down to the ones that nature has chosen. At their best, they might lead to deep new laws that account for the emergence of such phenomena as cells, ecosystems, and minds. By and large, the theoreticians have focused their attention on biology, and that makes sense. Organisms and their assemblages are the most complex systems known. They are also self-assembling and adaptive. Living systems in general, by constructing themselves from molecule to cell to organism to ecosystem, surely display whatever deep laws of complexity and emergence lie within our reach. Complexity theory was born in the 1970s, gathered momentum in the early 1980s, and was enveloped in controversy by the mid-1990s. The issues of contention are almost as tangled as the systems the theorists hope to unravel. I think it possible to cut to the heart of the matter as follows. The great majority of scientists, their minds focused narrowly on well-defined phenomena, do not care about complexity theory. Many have not yet heard of it. They, the uninvolved, can be ignored, lest all of contemporary science be thought of as a boiling cauldron of argument. Those who care can be divided into three camps. The first comprises a heterogeneous scattering of skeptics. They believe that brains and rainforests are too complicated ever to be reduced to elementary processes, let alone reconstituted in a manner that predicts the whole. Some of the skeptics doubt the existence of deep laws of complexity, at least any that can be grasped by the human mind. In the second camp are the fervent advocates, a band of audacious complexity theorists exemplified by Stuart Kaufman, author of The Origins of Order, and Christopher Langton, who work at the Santa Fe Institute in New Mexico, unofficial headquarters of the complexity movement. They believe not only that deep laws exist, but that their discovery is on the near horizon. Some of the essential elements of the laws, they say, are already emerging from mathematical theories that use exotic conceptions such as chaos, self-criticality, and adaptive landscapes. These abstractions bring into vivid focus the way complex systems might build themselves up, persist for a while, and then disintegrate. Their architects, computer-oriented, abstraction-absorbed, light on natural history, heavy on non-linear transformations, think they smell success. They believe that massive, computer-aided simulations, exploring many possible worlds, will reveal the methods and principles needed to leapfrog conventional science, including most of contemporary biology, to achieve a comprehensive understanding of the higher productions of the material world. Their grail is a set of hoped-for master algorithms that will speed passage from atom to brain and ecosystem, consistent with reality, but requiring far less factual knowledge than would be needed without the algorithms. The third group of scientists, of which I am a reluctant member, has settled along positions strung between the two extremes of rejection and unbridled support. I say reluctant because I would like to be a true believer. I really am impressed by the sophistication and elan of the complexity theorists, and my heart is with them. But my mind is not, at least not yet. I believe, with many other centrists, that they are on the right track, but only more or less, maybe, and still far short of success. Doubt and dissension on important issues have broken out even within their own ranks. The basic difficulty, to put the matter plainly, is an insufficiency of facts. The complexity theorists do not yet have enough information to carry with them into cyberspace. The postulates they start with clearly need more detail. Their conclusions, thus far, are too vague and general to be more than rallying metaphors, and their abstract conclusions tell us very little that is really new. Take the edge of chaos, one of the most frequently cited paradigms of complexity theory. It starts with the observation that in a system containing perfect internal order, such as a crystal, there can be no further change. At the opposite extreme, in a chaotic system, such as boiling liquid, there is very little order to change. The system that will evolve the most rapidly must fall between, and more precisely, on the edge of chaos, possessing order, but with the parts connected loosely enough to be easily altered, either singly or in small groups. Kaufman applied the concept to the evolution of life in his NK model. N is the number of parts in an organism, such as the number of genes or of amino acids, that contribute to its survival and reproduction, hence its representation in future generations. K is the number of parts of such kind, genes or amino acids, in the same organism that affect the contribution of any one of the parts. A gene, for example, does not act alone to guide the development of a cell. It acts with other genes, typically in a complicated fashion. Kaufman pointed out that if genes were completely interconnected in their effects, with K equaling N, there could be little or no evolution in a population of organisms, because one thing in the heredity of the organisms cannot be changed without changing everything. In the extreme opposite case, where there are no connections among the genes, so that K equals zero, the population is in evolutionary chaos. If each gene is on its own, the population of organisms evolves randomly across a near infinity of possible gene combinations, never stable in evolutionary time, never settling on one adaptive type. When connections exist, but are very few, the edge of chaos, evolving populations can settle on adaptive peaks, but are still capable of evolving with relative ease to other nearby adaptive peaks. A species of bird, for example, might shift from eating seeds to eating insects. A savanna plant might acquire the ability to grow in the desert. Being on the edge of chaos, Kaufman reasoned, provides the greatest evolvability. Perhaps species adjust the number of connections so as to remain in this most fluid of adaptive zones. Kaufman has spread the NK models to touch on a wide array of topics in molecular and evolutionary biology. His arguments, like those of other leading complexity theorists, are original and directed at important problems. First time around, they sound good, but as an evolutionary biologist familiar with genetics, I have learned little from them. While wading through Kaufman's equations and peculiarly Fustian prose, I realized that I already knew most of the results in a different context. They are essentially a reinvention of the wheel, a recreation in a difficult new language of principles already outlined in the mainstream literature of biology. Unlike the important theories of physics, the NK formulations do not shift the foundations of thought or offer predictions in measurable quantities. So far, they contain nothing to take into the field or laboratory. This personal and possibly unfair reaction to a single example is not to belittle the ultimate prospects of the complexity theorists. Some of the elementary concepts they have advanced, most notably chaos and fractal geometry, have assisted in understanding broad sectors of the physical world. In ecology, for example, the British biologist and mathematician Robert May has used realistic difference equations to derive patterns of population fluctuation of the kinds actually observed in plants and animals. As the rate of population growth increases, or as the environment relaxes its control of population growth, the number of individuals passes from a nearly steady state to a smooth up and down cycle. Then, as growth rate and environmental control change further, the number of individuals shifts to complex cycles with multiple peaks in time. Finally, the number slides into a chaotic regime, zigzagging up and down in no discernible pattern. The most interesting feature of chaos in populations is that it can be produced by exactly defined properties of real organisms. Contrary to previous belief, chaotic patterns are not necessarily the product of randomly acting forces of the environment that rock the population up and down. In this case, and in many other complex physical phenomena, chaos theory provides an authentically deep principle of nature. It says that extremely complicated, outwardly indecipherable patterns can be determined by small, measurable changes within the system. But again, which systems? Which changes? That is the nub of the problem. None of the elements of complexity theory has anything like the generality and the fidelity to factual detail we wish from theory. None has triggered an equivalent cascade of theoretical innovations and practical applications. What does complexity theory need to be successful in biology? Complexity theory needs more empirical information. Biology can supply it. 300 years in the making, having recently been wedded to physics and chemistry, biology is now a mature science. But its researchers may not require a body of special theory to master complexity. They have refined reductionism into a high art and begun to achieve partial syntheses at the level of the molecule and organelle. Even if complete cells and organisms are still beyond them, they know they can reconstruct some of the elements one at a time. They foresee no need for overarching grand explanations as a prerequisite for creating artificial life. An organism is a machine, and the laws of physics and chemistry, most believe, are enough to do the job, given sufficient time and research funding. Putting a living cell together will be a moonshot, not an Einsteinian revolution of space and time. Complexity in real organisms is being taken apart swiftly enough to enliven the pages of nature and science each week and drain away the need for conceptual revolution. A great vaulting revolution may occur, and suddenly, but the busy and well-fed masses of researchers are not awaiting it in desperate suspense. The machine the biologists have opened up is a creation of riveting beauty. At its heart are the nucleic acid codes, which in a typical vertebrate animal may comprise about 50,000 to 100,000 genes. Each gene is a string of 2,000 to 3,000 base pairs, genetic letters. Among the base pairs composing active genes, each triplet, set of three, translates into an amino acid. The final molecular products of the genes, as transcribed outward through the cell by scores of perfectly orchestrated chemical reactions, are sequences of amino acids folded into giant protein molecules. there are about 100,000 kinds of protein in a vertebrate animal. Where the nucleic acids are the codes, the proteins are the substance of life, making up half the animal's dry weight. They give form to the body, hold it together by collagen sinews, move it by muscle, catalyze all its animating chemical reactions, transport oxygen to all its parts, arm the immune system, and carry the signals by which the brain scans the environment and mediates behavior. The role a protein molecule plays is determined not just by its primary structure, not just by the sequence of amino acids within it, but also by its shape. The amino acid string of each kind is folded upon itself in a precise manner, coiled about like twine and crumpled together like a piece of wadded paper. The total molecule bears resemblance to forms as variable as clouds in the sky. Looking at these forms, we readily imagine lumpy spheres, donuts, dumbbells, ram's heads, angels with wings spread, and corkscrews. The resulting contours of the surface are particularly critical for the function of enzymes, the proteins that catalyze the body's chemistry. Somewhere on the surface is the active site, a pocket or groove consisting of a few of the amino acids, held in place by the architecture of the remaining amino acids. Only substrate molecules of a very specific form can fit the active site and submit to catalysis. As soon as one docks in the correct alignments, its active site alters shape slightly. The two molecules bind more closely, like hands clasped in greeting. Within an instant, the substrate molecule is changed chemically and released. In the embrace of the enzyme sucrase, for example, sucrose is cleaved into fructose and glucose. Just as swiftly, the active site of the enzyme molecule returns to its original shape with its chemical structure unchanged. The productivity of most types of enzyme molecules snapping in and out of the active state is prodigious. A single one can process 1,000 substrate molecules every second. How to put all these nanometer components and millisecond reactions together into a coherent picture? Biologists are determined to do it from the ground up, molecule by molecule, and metabolic pathway by metabolic pathway. They have begun to assemble the data and mathematical tools needed to model an entire cell. When they succeed, they will also have reached the level of entire simple organisms. The single-cell bacteria, archaea, and protists. Most biologists favor middle-level models in their theory of cell integration, neither primarily mathematical nor purely descriptive, but instead front-loaded with large amounts of empirical information and conceived as genetic networks. The flavor of this state-of-the-art approach has been nicely captured by two of the researchers, William Loomis and Paul Sternberg, as follows. The nodes of such networks are genes, or their RNA and protein products. The connections are the regulatory and physical interactions among the RNAs, proteins, and cis-regulatory DNA sequences of each gene. Modern molecular genetic techniques have greatly increased the rate at which genes are being recognized and their primary sequences determined. The challenge is to link the genes and their products into functional pathways, circuits, and networks. Analyses of regulatory networks, such as those involving signal transduction and transcriptional regulation cascades, illustrate combinatorial action that implements, for example, digital logic, analog digital conversions, crosstalk and insulation, and signal integration. Although the existence of sophisticated network elements has been suggested by decades of physiological studies, what is new is the scale and detail becoming available for the components. Much of current molecular biology focuses on identifying new components, defining the regulatory inputs and outputs of each node, and delineating the physiologically relevant pathways. The complexity conceived in this single paragraph exceeds that in supercomputers, million-part space vehicles, and all the other artifacts of human technology. Can scientists manage to explain it, and in a microscopic system to boot? The answer is undoubtedly yes. Yes, for social reasons, if no other. Scientists have been charged with conquering cancer, genetic disease, and viral infection, all of which are cellular disorders, and they are massively funded to accomplish these tasks. They know, roughly, the way to reach the goals demanded by the public, and they will not fail. Science, like art, and as always through history, follows patronage. Rapidly improving instrumentation already allows biologists to probe the interior of living cells and inspect the molecular architecture directly. They are discovering some of the simplicities by which adaptive systems organize themselves. Among the most notable simplicities are the rules used to fold the flexuous strings of amino acids into serviceable shapes of protein molecules, and the powered filtering devices by which membranes admit selected substances in and out of the cell and organelles. Scientists are also acquiring the computational capacity needed to simulate these and even more complex processes. In 1995, an American team using two linked Intel Paragon computers set a world speed record of 281 billion calculations per second. The U.S. Federal High Performance Program has upped the goal to a trillion calculations per second by the end of the century. By the year 2020, petacrunchers, capable of reaching 1,000 trillion calculations per second, may be possible, although new technologies and programming methods will be needed to reach that level. At this point, brute force simulation of cell mechanics, tracking every active molecule and its web of interactions, should be attainable, even without the simplifying principles envisioned in complexity theory. Scientists also foresee early solutions to the self-assembly of finished cells into tissues and whole multicellular organisms. In 1994, the editors of Science, celebrating the inauguration of developmental biology by Wilhelm Rue a century earlier, asked 100 contemporary researchers in the field to identify what they considered the crucial unanswered questions in the discipline. Their responses, in rank order of attributed importance, were 1. The molecular mechanisms of tissue and organ development, 2. The connection between development and genetic evolution, 3. The steps by which cells become committed to a particular fate, 4. The role of cell-to-cell signaling in tissue development, 5. The self-assembly of tissue patterns in the early embryo, 6. The manner in which nerve cells establish their specific connections to create the nerve cord and brain, 7. The means by which cells choose to divide and to die in the sculpting of tissues and organs, 8. The steps by which the processes controlling transcription, the transmission of DNA information within the cell, affect the differentiation of tissues and organs. Remarkably, the biologists considered research on all of these topics to be in a state of rapid advance, with partial success in at least some of them close at hand. Let us suppose that early in the next century, the hopes of the molecular and cellular biologists are fully realized. Suppose further that the researchers succeed in breaking a human cell down into all its component parts, track the processes, and accurately model the whole system from the molecules up. And suppose, finally, that the developmental biologists, whose focus is on tissues and organs, enjoy similar success. The stage will then be set for the final assault on the still more complex systems of mind and behavior. They are, after all, products of the self-same kinds of molecules, tissues, and organs. Let us see how such explanatory power might be acquired. With a close approximation of organic processes in a few species completed, it will be possible to infer how life is reproduced and maintained in an indefinite number of other species. With such an expansion of comparative holistic biology, a picture could be drawn of life as it is today, as it also was in the earliest stages of its evolution, and as it might be on other planets with different but habitable environments. In visualizing habitable environments, we will need to be liberal, keeping in mind that algae grow within rocks in Antarctica, and microorganisms thrive in the boiling water of deep sea thermal vents. At some point, deep and powerful principles of complexity may well emerge from the large ensemble of simulations. They will reveal the algorithms conserved across many levels of organization up to the most complex systems conceivable. These systems will be self-assembled, sustainable, and constantly changing, yet perfectly reproducing. In other words, they will be living organisms. At this time, if it comes, and I believe it will come, we will have a true theory of biology, as opposed to thick descriptions of particular living processes that now constitute the science. Its principles will accelerate inquiry into mind, behavior, and ecosystems, which are products of organisms, and by virtue of their extreme complexity, the ultimate challenge. So the important questions are, first, do general organizing principles exist that allow a living organism to be reconstituted in full without recourse to brute force simulation of all its molecules and atoms? Second, will the same principles apply to mind, behavior, and ecosystems? Third, is there a body of mathematics that will serve as a natural language for biology, parallel to the one that works so well for physics? Fourth, even if the correct principles are discovered, how detailed must factual information be in order to use those principles in the desired models? In all these matters we see today as through a glass darkly. In time, to complete the biblical illusion, we will come face to face with it all, and perhaps see it clearly. In any case, the search for answers will test the full powers of the human intellect. Chapter 6. The Mind. Belief in the intrinsic unity of knowledge, the reality of the labyrinth, rides ultimately on the hypothesis that every mental process has a physical grounding and is consistent with the natural sciences. The mind is supremely important to the consilience program for a reason both elementary and disturbingly profound. Everything that we know and can ever know about existence is created there. The loftier forms of such reflection and belief may seem at first to be the proper domain of philosophy, not science, but history shows that logic, launched from introspection alone, lacks thrust, can travel only so far, and usually heads in the wrong direction. Much of the history of modern philosophy, from Descartes and Kant forward, consists of failed models of the brain. The shortcoming is not the fault of the philosophers, who have doggedly pushed their methods to the limit, but a straightforward consequence of the biological evolution of the brain. All that has been learned empirically about evolution in general, and mental process in particular, suggests that the brain is a machine assembled not to understand itself, but to survive. Because these two ends are basically different, the mind, unaided by factual knowledge from science, sees the world only in little pieces. It throws a spotlight on those portions of the world it must know in order to live to the next day, and surrenders the rest to darkness. For thousands of generations, people lived and reproduced with no need to know how the machinery of the brain works. Myth and self-deception, tribal identity and ritual, more than objective truth, gave them the adaptive edge. That is why even today, people know more about their automobiles than they do about their own minds, and why the fundamental explanation of mind is an empirical rather than a philosophical or religious quest. It requires a journey into the brain's interior darkness with preconceptions left behind. The ships that brought us here are to be left scuttled and burning at the shore. The brain is a helmet-shaped mass of gray and white tissue, about the size of a grapefruit, 1 to 2 quarts in volume, and on average weighing 3 pounds. Einstein's brain, for example, was 2.75 pounds. Its surface is wrinkled, like that of a cleaning sponge, and its consistency is custard-like, firm enough to keep from puddling on the floor of the brain case, soft enough to be scooped out with a spoon. The brain's true meaning is hidden in its microscopic detail. Its fluffy mass is an intricately wired system of about 100 billion nerve cells, each a few millionths of a meter wide, and connected to other nerve cells by hundreds or thousands of endings. If we could shrink ourselves to the size of a bacterium and explore the brain's interior on foot, as philosophers since Leibniz in 1713 have imagined doing, we might eventually succeed in mapping all the nerve cells and tracking all the electrical circuits. But we could never thereby understand the whole. Far more information is needed. We need to know what the electric patterns mean, as well as how the circuits were put together, and, most puzzling of all, for what purpose. What we know of the heredity and development of the brain shows them to be almost unimaginably complicated. The Human Genome Database, accumulated to 1995, reveals that the brain's structure is prescribed by at least 3,195 distinctive genes, 50% more than for any other organ or tissue. The total number of genes in the entire human genome is estimated to be 50,000 to 100,000. The molecular processes that guide the growth of neurons to their assigned places have only begun to be deciphered. Overall, the human brain is the most complex object known in the universe, known, that is, to itself. It rose by evolution to its present form swiftly, even by the standards of the generally hurried pace of mammalian phylogeny evident in the fossil record. Across 3 million years, from the ancestral man-apes of Africa to the earliest anatomically modern Homo sapiens, who lived about 200,000 years ago, the brain increased in volume 4 times over. Much of the growth occurred in the neocortex, the seat of the higher functions of mind, including, especially, language and its symbol-based product, culture. The result was the capacity to take possession of the planet. Advanced humans their big spherical skulls teetering precariously on fragile stems of compacted cervical vertebrae, walked, paddled, and sailed out of Africa, through Europe and Asia, and thence to all the remaining continents and great archipelagos except uninhabitable Antarctica. By 1000 AD, they reached the outermost islands of the Pacific and Indian Oceans. Only a handful of remote mid-Atlantic islands, including St. Helena and the Azores, remained pristine for a few centuries longer. It is, I must acknowledge, unfashionable in academic circles nowadays to speak of evolutionary progress. All the more reason to do so. In fact, the dilemma that has consumed so much ink can be evaporated with a simple semantic distinction. If we mean by progress the advance toward a preset goal, such as that composed by intention in the human mind, then evolution by natural selection, which has no preset goals, is not progress. But if we mean the production through time of increasingly complex and controlling organisms and societies, in at least some lines of descent, with regression always a possibility, then evolutionary progress is an obvious reality. In this second sense, the human attainment of high intelligence and culture ranks as the last of the four great steps in the overall history of life. They followed one upon the other at roughly 1 billion-year intervals. The first was the beginning of life itself in the form of simple bacterium-like organisms. Then came the origin of the complex eukaryotic cell through the assembly of the nucleus and other membrane-enclosed organelles into a tightly organized unit. With the eukaryotic building block available, the next advance was the origin of large multicellular animals such as crustaceans and mollusks, whose movements were guided by sense organs and central nervous systems. Finally, to the grief of most pre-existing life forms, came humanity. Virtually all contemporary scientists and philosophers expert on the subject agree that the mind, which comprises consciousness and rational process, is the brain at work. They have rejected the mind-brain dualism of René Descartes, who in Meditationes, 1642, concluded that by the divine power the mind can exist without the body and the body without the mind. According to the great philosopher, the non-corporeal mind, and hence the immortal soul, repose somewhere in the corporeal and mortal body. Its location, he suggested, might be the pineal gland, a tiny organ located at the base of the brain. In this early neurobiological model, the brain receives information from all over the body and feeds it into the pineal headquarters, where it is translated somehow into conscious thought. Dualism was congenial to the philosophy and science of Descartes' time, appealing as it did to the materialistic explanation of the universe, while remaining safely pious. In one form or other, it has persisted into the late 20th century. The brain and its satellite glands have now been probed to the point where no particular site remains that can reasonably be supposed to harbor a non-physical mind. The pineal gland, for example, is known to secrete the hormone melatonin and to assist in regulating the body's biological clock and daily rhythms. But even as mind-body dualism is being completely abandoned at long last in the 1990s, scientists remain unsure about the precise material basis of mind. Some are convinced that conscious experience has unique physical and biological properties that remain to be discovered. A few among them, archly called the Mysterians by their colleagues, believe that conscious experience is too alien, too complex, or both, ever to be comprehended, No doubt the transcendent difficulty of the subject inspires this kind of denial. As late as 1970, most scientists thought the concept of mind a topic best left to philosophers. Now the issue has been joined where it belongs, at the juncture of biology and psychology. With the aid of powerful new techniques, researchers have shifted the frame of discourse to a new way of thinking, expressed in the language of nerve cells, neurotransmitters, hormone surges, and recurrent neural networks. The cutting edge of the endeavor is cognitive neuroscience, also and more popularly known as the brain sciences, an alliance formed by neurobiologists, cognitive psychologists, and a new school of empirically minded philosophers, sometimes referred to as neurophilosophers. Their research reports are dispatched weekly to premier scientific journals, and their theories and impassioned disagreements fill the pages of such open commentary periodicals as Behavioral and Brain Sciences. Many of the popular books and articles they write rank among the best in contemporary science exposition. Such traits are the hallmark of the heroic period, or romantic period, as it is often called, experienced by every successful scientific discipline during its youth. For a relatively brief interval, usually a decade or two, rarely more than half a century, researchers are intoxicated with a mix of the newly discovered and the imaginable unknown. For the first time, the really important questions are asked in a form that can be answered thus. What are the cellular events that compose the mind? Not create the mind, too vague that expression, but compose the mind. The pioneers are paradigm hunters. They are risk takers who compete with rival theorists for big stakes and are willing to endure painful shakeouts. They bear comparison with explorers of the 16th century who, having discovered a new coastline, worked rivers up to the fall line, drew crude maps, and commuted home to beg for more expeditionary funds. And governmental and private patrons of the brain scientists, like Royal Geographic Commissions of past centuries, are generous. They know that history can be made by a single sighting of coastland, where inland lies virgin land, and the future lineaments of empire. Call the impulse Western, if you wish. Call it androcentric. And by all means, dismiss it as colonialist, if you feel you must. I think it instead basic to human nature. Whatever its source, the impulse drives major scientific advance. During my career, I have been privileged to witness, close at hand, the heroic periods of molecular biology, plate tectonics in geology, and the modern synthesis of evolutionary biology. Now, it is the turn of the brain sciences. The early groundwork for the revolution was laid in the 19th century by physicians who noticed that injuries to certain parts of the brain result in special kinds of disability. Perhaps the most famous case was that of Phineas P. Gage, who in 1848 was a young construction foreman in charge of a crew laying railroad track across Vermont. Part of the job was to blast away outcrops of hard rock in order to straighten out turns in the advancing path. As Gage pressed powder into a newly drilled hole, a premature explosion fired the iron tamping bar like a missile toward his head. It entered his left cheek and exited the top of his skull, carrying with it a good part of the prefrontal lobe of his cerebral cortex, then arced away more than 100 feet before coming to earth. Gage fell to the ground, miraculously still alive. To the amazement of all, he was able within minutes to sit up and even walk with assistance. He never lost consciousness. "Wonderful accident," was the later headline in the Vermont Mercury. In time, his external injuries healed, and he retained the ability to speak and reason. But his personality had changed drastically. Where previously he had been cheerful, responsible, and well-mannered, a valued employee of the Rutland and Burlington Railroad, now he was a habitual liar, unreliable at work, and given to vagrant, self-destructive behavior. Studies on other patients with injuries to the same part of the brain over many years have confirmed the general conclusion suggested by Gage's misfortune. The prefrontal lobe houses centers important for initiative and emotional balance. For two centuries, the medical archives have filled with such anecdotes on the effects of localized brain damage. The data have made it possible for neurologists to piece together a map of functions performed by different parts of the brain. The injuries which occur throughout the brain include physical traumas, strokes, tumors, infections, and poisoning. They vary in extent from barely detectable pinpoints to deletions and transections of large parts of the brain. Depending on location and magnitude, they have multifarious effects on thought and behavior. The most celebrated recent case is that of Karen Ann Quinlan. On April 14, 1975, the young New Jersey woman, while dosed with the tranquilizer Valium and painkiller drug Darvon, made the mistake of drinking gin and tonic. Although the combination does not sound dangerous, it essentially killed Karen Ann Quinlan. She fell into a coma that lasted until her death from massive infections 10 years later. An autopsy revealed that her brain was largely intact, which explains why her body survived and even continued its daily cycle of waking and sleep. It lived on, even when Quinlan's parents arranged, in the midst of national controversy, to have her ventilator removed. The autopsy revealed that Quinlan's brain damage was local but very severe. The thalamus had been obliterated, as though burned out with a laser. Why that particular center deteriorated is unknown. A brain injured by a heavy blow or certain forms of poisoning usually responds by widespread swelling. If the reaction is intense, it presses on centers that control heartbeat and respiration, shutting down blood circulation, and soon ending in death of the whole body. The result of thalamus excision alone is brain death, or, more precisely put, mind death. The thalamus comprises twin, egg-shaped masses of nerve cells near the center of the brain. It functions as a relay center through which all sensory information other than smell is transmitted to the cerebral cortex, and therefore to the conscious mind. Even dreams are triggered by impulses that pass through thalamic circuits. Quinlan's drug accident was the equivalent of blowing up a power station. All her lights downline went out, and she entered a sleep from which she had no chance of wakening. Her cerebral cortex lived on, waiting to be activated, but consciousness, even in dreams, was no longer possible. Such research on brain damage, while enormously informative, is nevertheless dependent on chance occurrence. Over the years, it has been greatly enhanced by experimental brain surgery. Neurosurgeons routinely keep patients conscious to test their response to electrical stimulation of the cortex in order to locate healthy tissue and avoid excising it. The procedure is not uncomfortable. Brain tissue, while processing impulses from all over the body, has no receptors of its own. Instead of pain, the roving probes evoke a medley of sensations and muscular contractions. When certain sites on the surface of the cortex are stimulated, patients experience images, melodies, incoherent sounds, and a gamut of other impressions. Sometimes they involuntarily move fingers and other body parts. Beginning with experiments in brain surgery by Wilder Penfield and other pioneers in the 1920s and 1930s, researchers have mapped sensory and motor functions over all parts of the cerebral cortex. The method is nevertheless limited in two important respects. It is not easily extended beneath the cortex into the dark nether regions of the brain, and it can